Take your golf expertise to the next level with Links Premier, unlocking the most exciting and insightful coverage of the game's courses, travel, communities, architecture, and more. With Links Premier, our latest subscription tiers offer something for everyone. Whether you enjoy reading the print edition of Links, clicking through our digital magazine, scrolling around linksmagazine.com, or all of the above. Plus, subscribers receive priority notifications for exclusive Links events, a welcome discount code to the Links online shop, and much more. Get your all-access pass today by visiting linksmagazine.com and clicking the subscribe link. Welcome back to the Links Golf Podcast. I'm one of your co-hosts, Al Lunsford, digital editor for Links, joined, as always, by my co-host, Joe Passoff. Today, we are thrilled to be joined by another golf course architect. His name is Bill Bergen. Bill, thanks for joining us today. We noticed you've got your polo on, a great-looking logo for a new golf course you're working on called The Keep. Folks may be familiar with Macklemore. Joe called the 18th hole at Macklemore's Highlands course one of the top 10 finishing holes in the world. And you had your hands on that and making that happen. So this is a new course, a second 18-hole course at Macklemore. Can you tell us a little bit about this project, where you're at with it, when it's supposed to open, and some highlights about what makes this design different for you?
Absolutely, Al. And good morning, Joe. You know, it's interesting because the 18th hole at the Macklemore golf course was a brand new golf hole. So that was a 17-hole renovation, and then we added an 18th hole. And I am 100% convinced without that 18th hole and the notoriety and photography and all of the attention that it has garnered, we would not have a hotel on the mountain right next to it, and we would not have this new golf course that's nearing completion called The Keep, which would be the second golf course there. That hole, you know, it was a brainchild really of sort of our land planner and our owner, Dwayne Horton and Roland Aberg. And we had a problem. We didn't have room for the clubhouse on this golf course. So Macklemore was an existing golf course called Canyon Ridge. Then it was developed and kind of got lost in the recession of 2008 through 2010 and really came out poorly on the other end of that. And then our group came in to refurbish it. They hired me to renovate the golf course. And along the way, they knew they wanted to do a hotel. And that's part of the reason Reese got involved is Roland, who's not a golfer and really only knew who Tom Fazio and Jack Nicklaus were, honestly, and Reese Jones. He knew who Reese Jones was. He said, you know, hey, Bill, I know you're going to do a great job, but we need some marketing punch here to have this hotel. And so I had done a project down in Central Florida in Winter Haven. And the owner there was a fraternity brother of Reese's, and he had hired me to do the golf course. And he said, hey, would you mind if Reese came down and consulted a little bit with you? And I was a little taken back at first because the design was done. We hadn't started construction, but the design was finished. I was like, well, you know, that'd be great. And kind of changed my mind. I thought, hey, you know, why not? And so we hit it off really nicely. Reese, on that course, stayed out of my way and really just came down and had some nice little insights, and we enjoyed being together and I got to know him. And that was, you know, kind of a fun process. And I look at Reese and Bob Cupp as my, you know, modern day mentors of guys that, you know, who have influenced me over the, you know, my design career. And then when Roland said, hey, we need a little more marketing punch at Macklemore if we're going to do a hotel, I said, well, I know Reese and he might be interested. So we called him up and he said, absolutely. And so, you know, his role on the first course was pretty minimal. I did most all the work there. You know, the 18th hole is definitely my hole. But, you know, he definitely was involved in advising and collaborating with me. And that, you know, that course has turned out well. And then the owners went and said, okay, we're going to do another one and we'd like you guys to team up. And it's funny because, you know, I, of course, would have liked to do as much work as absolutely possible. And Reese looked at this site. He goes, oh, no, we're going to share this. It's too nice.
Well, and yeah. Macklemore's whole deal is being above the clouds, and I don't think I mentioned this. It's Northwest Georgia, Lookout Mountain. So at the very top, you know, I think 1,500 feet above the valley below it, and the first course, the Highlands course, has that one cliffside hole. It has some holes that you can see over the cliff, but not really right next to the cliff edge. The new course has five cliffside holes right on the edge. So what makes it different?
So the first course is really your true mountain golf course. We go down into valleys, we climb up on hills, we have views, we have, you know, we have terrain changes, we have cart paths where you have to go from green to tee, and some of them are lengthy. And we have real estate. And so it's a classic mountain type environment, although the views are tremendous and they're long views. You know, I do a lot of work in Western North Carolina, and I'd call those intimate views. Whereas Macklemore is more Western. It's just big, bold, and broad. And so you have that kind of look. And then you go down the road a mile and a half to the Keep, same elevation. And we have a high plateau that sits along the edge of the mountain. And so we have this golf course. You mentioned five holes being along the edge, and that's absolutely true. But every hole looks over the edge, and the course is completely walkable, intimate from green to tee, even though it's a massive, vast golf course. You just walk off one green, you go to the next hole, and off you go. There's no real estate component that's going to interfere with golf at all. And from the 16th green, you can see all 18 holes. So think about that. Think about being on a golf course anywhere, and you're sitting on one spot of the golf course and you see every hole. And I think that's just a phenomenal aspect about this property. So it is wide open. It's windy. It's very bold. The word awe fits very nicely. I know it's an overused word, but it fits this property. It's kind of mouth dropping when you get your first look at it.
Yeah. Not only can you see every hole from what I read, you can see for 50 miles beyond that, because you, like you said, you're just on this elevated plateau. I read it was kind of like a headland style. So think like Old Head, but over in the mountains, overlooking the land and the sky beyond. Very different, and loved Reese Jones's quote about it. You'll need to be sure to bring two things to this course, your A game and your camera.
Yeah, it's, you know, I find it the most distracting golf course property I've worked on. You need blinders like a horse to play the course. It's going to be really interesting when people start experiencing it, because you are drawn, your eyes are drawn in so many different directions. And yet at the same time, each hole is very distinct and memorable. They stand alone. Each hole stands alone amongst this huge open, you know, vast property. And so that's an interesting combination, because, you know, we get a lot of courses today right now. Obviously, the sandier the site, the better. And, you know, I would say that I love that type of golf, and you get angles and dunes and all kinds of things, but the holes sort of run together just a little bit, and you have to really pay attention to understand the holes and to remember them. And the Keep, I've never been on a golf course that's more memorable. Now, admittedly, I'm biased, designed it, laid it out, been working on it every week for a year and a half or more. But it's just so distinct and so easy to remember the flow of this golf course.
Bill, you know, it's easy to understand how the Highlands course now earns its name at Macklemore, but where did you all come up with the name The Keep for the new course?
So that's an interesting story. So the original premise, and Dwayne Horton is our managing partner of all of Macklemore, everything that's involved up there. And Dwayne is such an interesting gentleman. He's an idea guy. He never is short on ideas, and most of them good. And the good news is, if they're not, if you say, "Hey, Dwayne, I'm not sure about that," he's fine with that. But he's that guy who is so creative and always looking at things. And he wanted rather than a traditional 18-hole golf course, it starts at number one. You know, the nines and 10, you know, come back to the clubhouse and you finish at 18 at the clubhouse. He wanted to use this property because it's like a crescent. It kind of, you know, arches around this edge. And there's an outpost spot that we originally were going to call it the outpost, because there's this outpost spot that he wanted to put basically more than a halfway house, but less than a clubhouse, as this, the main area, south outpost. And then you go around to the ninth hole and there's a northern one. And he wanted to do the same thing there. And he wanted a north outpost and a south outpost. And he really didn't care where he started playing golf on this course. You come down from the top of the hill where there's going to be an inn and check in and pro shop type thing. And you'd come down and you could really sort almost start anywhere. But with these two outposts as anchors on the site, and the one outpost originally, we were going to have a fire tower and you just could be able to climb up and have this view that was all over. And that's been since changed, but the architecture on that outpost is going to be absolutely phenomenal. I know the architect involved did the clubhouse architect at Macklemore and did the hotel, the new Cloudland Hotel. And he said this building is his favorite of any project he's ever worked on. So my level of anticipation to see what he comes up with there. And it's all glass and stone and metal and, you know, perfectly situated right on the edge of the cliff. So that's going to be fantastic. But that's leading to the outpost. So originally, that's what we called it. And then there's an outpost club that's a golfing club that kind of raised a stink about it and said, hey, that's our name. And so rather than getting involved in any of that, we searched for a new name. And our marketing department, led by Ivy Whitman, and I'm sure Charlie Reimer was involved and Dwayne was involved and there are numerous other people, came up with the Keep, which is basically a strong part of a castle. On the edge of a castle. And so I was actually a little reluctant at first. I didn't love it because I really loved the outpost. And when I saw the logo for the Keep, that melted away. I love the logo. And Macklemore's logo sells more shirts and sweaters and things than you can imagine. People love these logos and they're recognizable. I fly all the time. And, a lot of time I'm doing site work and coming back in town to Atlanta and somebody will see my hat with a Macklemore logo on it. Oh, have you played the course? Well, yeah, I actually have designed it. But anyway, it's they do a great job marketing. And the Keep logo, I can't wait till they get more gear because I will be wearing it all the time, as will most people who come up there.
Well, I think, Bill, the Keep, you're going to get a favor from fans of Game of Thrones are going to understand what the Keep is because of the Red Keep. It's where the Iron Throne is in Game of Thrones. So anyone like me who has thought, like, where have I heard Keep before? Game of Thrones, help you out there.
Watch the whole series. So and Matt, who works for me, is a huge fan of almost all fantasy literature type stuff. And so, I will mention to him today that you've mentioned that. So that's a fun connection.
Definitely. Take your golf expertise to the next level with Lynx Premier, unlocking the most exciting and insightful coverage of the game's courses, travel, communities, architecture, and more. With Lynx Premier, our latest subscription tiers offer something for everyone. Whether you enjoy reading the print edition of Lynx, clicking through our digital magazine, scrolling around lynxmagazine.com, or all of the above. Plus, subscribers receive priority notifications for exclusive Lynx events, a welcome discount code to the Lynx online shop, and much more. Get your all-access pass today by visiting lynxmagazine.com and clicking the subscribe link.
Tell us about the process in discovering building the 18th hole on the original course, the Highlands at Macklemore.
That's a perfect question, Joe. And I started to go down that path and forgot where I was going earlier. But so we had a problem. we didn't have room. The 18th hole for the original Canyon Ridge Golf Course sat on the edge of this high plateau that the entire keep occupies. So it was there. I don't think they had quite cleared enough trees to really open up the view substantially, but it was there along the edge of that high plateau. But the clubhouse for the original golf course was not built, and the parking lot was woefully inadequate. And so Roland with Hart Howerton said, "Hey, we need space. Is there anything we can do? Can we go down below?" And so I said, "Let me go check." And literally I hiked down. I mean, it's a 100-foot drop on a, 25% grade or steeper to get down to this one spot. And there was actually a reasonably decent greens complex spot. Okay, reasonably decent. And then as you moved north up the fairway towards the teeing area, it started to tighten up. And then there were boulders the size of a 4,000 square foot house, and it was pretty much a mess. And so, but I knew we could build a hole. I didn't know how long we could build it, meaning what the yardage would be, but I knew I had a green site. And so literally Matt and I took, we didn't have really decent topo, and we took a grade rod down there and we kind of mapped it out and said, okay, we can do this. And then Southeastern Golf, who was building the golf course for us, they're good problem solvers. You have an issue to deal with, and Scott Beasy and his team are good at solving problems. And so literally we had to wait because to clear it, which would really open it up, because Georgia has a basically clearing window from October 1st to May 1st that you're allowed to clear and burn. And if you saw that site, which you have, Joe, you couldn't get the trees out of there. So you had to burn them. And so, in fact, getting irrigation down there, getting cart path down there, getting things down there was a monumental feat of construction. And so anyway, we were able to, basically cut the right side, fill the left side. We were able to mix blasted rock with natural rock and really come up with an exceptional location for a golf hole. It's not the easiest hole in the world by any means. The fairway slopes a little bit more from right to left than I would prefer. But it's a beautiful greens complex. It's an exciting hole. It's a, you par it and you feel like you really accomplished something, and it's hard to play it without taking a picture. And so, it's a beautiful place. It gets a lot of attention, and people are really excited to spend time there. And Al, like you said, it literally drops 1200 feet right off the left edge of the green. And so anecdotally, a fun story, my son took my dad up to play it, and unfortunately he played 17 holes and he never got out of the cart on number 18.
Oh no.
He said, "My legs are wobbling. I can't get out there." And so he skipped that hole that day, but it's really not a problem. There's more room than it looks, and the edge isn't dire. So I am glad that golf carts are geofenced these days, but otherwise it's a fine hole.
That probably gives the pro shop some level of comfort in no one attempting to really drive over there.
I love that story about your dad, Bill. I mean, like going out to Pebble Beach and, finishing up the par 3 17th and say, I've had enough today. Yeah, let's just pack it in from here.
So, Bill, people who aren't familiar with you probably don't know that you began playing, not began, but early in your life, you were a player on the PGA Tour and had some pretty good success. I want to know, because I was looking back at your career. I mean, I know you have a great finish at St. Andrews, T14, I believe it was, one of the years that the Open was there. But just seeing your best results, I really want to know what it was about the Provident Classic in Tennessee that just, like, you had a T4 and a T6 there. Like, what was it about that tournament? And maybe that course looks like it was played at Valley Brook
during
the years that you were out there.
You're kind of being generous about my playing career, but I got a great taste of professional golf. I played in 3 US Opens, 2 British Opens, and played in 50 tour events. I made 17 cuts. One out of three is not very good. But I grew up with Bob Tway, and Bob sort of set a bar for all of us in my part of in Georgia. Bob was in Georgia at the time. And our high school golf team junior year never lost a match, never lost a tournament, never lost anything. We had 3 guys play college golf out of one high school golf team, which was, and 2 guys made it to the tour. So it was a phenomenal time to kind of grow up as a young guy. And Bob really did teach me how to play golf. I mean, he was the best when he moved to Georgia, and we all hung out and played golf all the time. And really had a great experience together. And then, I won the Georgia Amateur when I was a senior at Auburn. And I qualified for US Open as an amateur, which, you know, you do that, and that's pretty exciting for any of the young college kids that get to play in the US Open. It's also, it's eyes wide open. I played it at Baldstrahl in 1980. When Jack Nicklaus won, and I barely broke 80 both days, and Jack shot 63 one day. And so I'm like, okay, a stroke a hole, that's all the farther I am behind Nicklaus right now. but what a great experience that was. And then, you know, I turned professional in at the end of 81 after I graduated from college, and was able to play at Pebble Beach in the US Open. And that's my biggest disappointment, actually, as a golfer, I think. I was playing so well going into Pebble Beach. I'd won two 54-hole events in a row on the mini tours in Florida by 5 shots each. I was playing really good, qualify for the U.S. Open at Pebble, go out there and have a good first day, and then I missed the cut by 1, playing in the very last group on Friday. And, you know, I finished at 11:30 East Coast time. And while you're in California and you are adapting to the time, it still was one really, really, really long day, and to miss the cut by 1 was heartbreaking. And I played the 7th hole 3 over par for the 2 days. So there you go. Missed the cut, you know, that 7th hole. But yeah, I got to, you know, I wanted to play golf professionally. You know, I kind of took, had a lot of really good opportunities, but in 1984, the PGA Tour had a satellite tour, which is really the beginning of what, you know, was the web.com, but it was called the TPS Tour, Tournament Player Series. And the idea of it at the time was for young player development and players who were 45 or so older getting ready for the Champions Tour who weren't competitive on the PGA Tour anymore. So we had some big, Gary Player played in some of these events. Hubert Green, I think, played in some of these events. We had some big names play in some of the events. And so the Provident Classic in Chattanooga was one of those events. And in 1984, I was traveling with a guy named Charlie Bowling, who's out of the Met section. And Charlie goes, you know, you can enter the British Open qualifier as a U.S. professional, and you only have to go to the final qualifier. You don't have to go to a local. You can just go to the final. And it's at St. Andrews. And he goes, you need to do this. You need to enter this. And so I did. I sent the money in to St. Andrews to qualify for the 1984 British Open. And I was playing on that TPS tour. And I decided if I had the funds, the money to do it, I would go do it. And I finished I had a good finish. And then I had a second up in New Hampshire, and off I went to Scotland. And it was such a fun memory. It was 40 years ago now. So a long time ago. But I fly into London, I take a train, I take a taxi, I took a bus, I took everything but a boat to get to London Links up in St. Andrews and up near St. Andrews. And those qualifiers were 2 days. You know, I was used to, I'd played in 2 US Opens at that time, so I was used to the 36-hole in 1 day qualifiers. You know, that's what I liked. And being 25 years old, that was a tremendous advantage for young guys in shape. You know, the more golf you got to play in 1 day, the better off you were. And so over there, though, it was 2 separate days. And first, I played three practice rounds, and the wind blew totally in different directions. So talk about a course being unrecognizable. I'm on this golf course for three straight days, but it is a different golf course every day. And so you don't know what you're going to get in the tournament, but I had experienced a lot of variety during the practice. And so ended up shooting 71, 65. 65 was the course record at the time. And with a bogey on the last hole, because there was OB left and there was no chance I was going to miss this qualifying for the US, for the British Open. No chance. And so I kind of wide right, make bogey, and off I go to St. Andrews. And what's exciting about that is that's on Monday of British Open week. You don't even get a Monday practice round. So you go over to St. Andrews on Tuesday morning, and you're in, you know, it's mid practice round week for the Open Championship. And so off we go. And I played a practice round with Charlie Bowling, the guy who suggested he'd won the South African Open that year. And so played a practice round with Charlie and a couple other guys. And it was funny because my first tee shot at St. Andrews, I think, still stands as the most nervous I've ever been on a golf course. I had this adrenaline rush that just ran through my body, and I couldn't feel the club. And it was a practice round, and it's one thing you always talk about when you watch professional golfers and you look at, you know, Ekerud, who won yesterday or Monday. You can't practice for adrenaline and nerves. They just, you get used to them, but you can't prepare for them. And so I think, you know, we practice to deal with that, but it's a big deal. So anyway, I ended up making the cut at St. Andrews by one, and then I shot 33-33 on Saturday, which was the 66 was equally low for the week. That was the best round. Tom Watson shot 66, Baker Finch shot 66, and Sam Torrence shot 66. So that's a moment that I think has really impacted my design career, just my golf career. That moment. And then I was paired with Nick Faldo the final day. So that was fun. And I actually shot 33. I shot 33 again on the front. So I shot three straight 33s and went from the cut line to fifth in 27 holes. So that was the best golf I have ever played and will ever play for a brief moment. And so it was pretty exciting. And playing with Faldo ended up being pretty fun. He didn't say a word till the eighth hole, and we both birdied the eighth hole, and then he talked the rest of the day. The more he talked, the better he played, and the worse I played, which, you know. anyway, but it was being in St. Andrews in 1984 and looking back as an architect to have played that Open Championship. I was on the steps of the R&A when Seve won. And to play, you know, Pebble Beach in the 82 U.S. Open as an architect, both of those things really, you know, they're important to me. And not a lot of guys can say that do what I do.
Joe, Bill has what I would consider you have impeccable memories. Both of you guys are just like the detail you have in your recall is impressive and something I don't think I have, because Bill, you're just like rifling off these things like it happened yesterday. So I'm just wondering, you know, maybe the St. Andrews would qualify for this, but what would you say was your most memorable round as a player based on who you played with or how you played, where you played? What do you think?
I had three moments that are really impactful. That 66 at St. Andrews, absolutely, probably at the top. I shot 65 to win the Georgia Amateur in the final round, came from 10 shots or 7 shots behind to win by 3. That was a big deal. And, you know, in Georgia, you know, I care about golf in Georgia a lot, and I'm proud to be part of the history of the golf in the state and proud to work on the golf courses here in this state. And so that was a big deal. And then back to what I talked about growing up with Bob Tway, we played together the final round of the 1986 Atlanta Classic, and he won. And we were paired together. We're two high school friends, and we weren't in the last group. We were in the second or third to last group. And walking down the 18th fairway in front of all kinds of family, friends, and Atlanta people, that was such a fun moment. And you know, he had such a great year that year, Player of the Year. And you know, it was a really cool thing. So anyway, that was those
yeah,
three
those are
things.
some fantastic playing highlights. I mean, as modest as you may assess your overall career, when you have some of those individual highlights, spotlight moments that you can point to and say, yeah, I had the low round of the week at the Open Championship at St. Andrews, you know, and Tom Watson and Ian Baker Finch joined me, and I played the fourth round with Nick Faldo. I mean, those are not the kinds of normal, regular memories that most people can draw on. So that's just phenomenal. So as a player, you know, being a Southeastern guy, you grew up with rolling hills and trees lining the fairways, and even Pebble, the Pebble Beach Open of 82. I mean, you're sitting up high at Pebble, but I remember the setup for that year. I mean, tiny greens, super thick rough, which seemed to bother everybody except Tom Watson at the 71st hole.
Yeah.
But it's a different kind of golf, completely different than what you encountered at St. Andrews. So what did you take from those experiences growing up, the courses that you played, then playing Earth's greatest courses that were so different from Pebble to St. Andrews? And how did you apply that in your thinking about what you like in golf courses and how that would influence your designs?
That's a great question. And that's one of the things that I think makes golf the greatest game. We get to play in such diverse environments and under diverse conditions, and it's never the same. You know, the permutations for golf are endless. And so I think there's no better game because of that. And I think there's no, you know, at the ASGC annual meeting every year, we always talk about there is no greater profession than golf course architecture. And I really believe that. And I'm also feel lucky that I quite honestly wasn't a better player at this stage in my life and this stage in my golf career. Had I been a better player, I may not be sitting here. I may not be working on courses like the Keep or, you know, having an impact on people's enjoyment of playing golf for decades to come. And so back to your question, you know, I thought Pebble Beach in the 1982 US Open was my favorite golf course for decades and still could be. I also played in the Crosby in 1985, different golf course, different experience. Fine. Not the same as a US Open. And so, you know, people always, you know, you get a chance, you know, people want to go play these great golf courses. And unfortunately, you're only allowed to experience what it is that day. And that may not be the same, you know, on another situation. And St. Andrews, I after my experience there, I really didn't want to go back and mar that experience. I wanted to leave that as a memory. And I was invited to go back a few years ago, and I accepted. And I got off the airplane, and I'm staying in the hotel right on the 18th hole. I got off the airplane. I'm in jeans and loafers, and it's jet lagged. And the first thing I do is grab a camera, and I walk out, and it's crowded. It's Sunday. Course is closed, and it's crowded on 17 green and 18 and the road crossing 18. There's a lot of people there. And I walked all 18 holes. And when I got out to middle of number two fairway, I didn't see another person until I got back to 17 green. And I had St. Andrews and those memories of the British Open experience and a camera and a different eye. You know, as a player, I mapped that golf course from right to left. Okay. So I had a good yardage book. And this is 1984 when you didn't have yardage books, but I made one. I bought one and then made it. And I mapped the golf course from right to left because all the trouble's down the right side and you can see down the right side. And if you hit it left, you can't see anything. And so, you know, you can play left all day, but you can't ever access the hole locations, but you're safe. And so, you know, strategically, I really kind of understood the golf course very quickly. And I didn't have any design experience at the time. I just was a student of studying as much as I could get out of the golf course. And then when I went back and as a architect, I didn't realize how flat that golf course was when I played it. I just didn't pay any attention to it. And I realized, wow, this thing is flat as a board and you can't see anything because there's obstacles, there's gorse, there's dunes, there's bunkers, there's junk, there's swales. I mean, I think it's brilliant. And I think my appreciation for the golf course has definitely grown tremendously over the year. I loved it. It was my greatest golf experience. But going back and looking at it from a different perspective made a difference. And then the last thing about your question, I actually think I enjoy playing golf in the wind. Not everybody does. And I think the reason I enjoy it is that it's sort of point and shoot and calculate rather than golf swing. You don't think about your golf swing when you're playing on a windy day. You think about start line and you think about calculating what is the wind going to do to the ball. And it's a different way of looking at it. And I have played decently, I would say, in the wind. And that brings us to the keep. When you have a mountain edge golf course where you cleared 200 acres, it's windy. And you might laugh at this comment, but I didn't recognize that at the very first in designing the golf course, because the other golf course, you get snippets of wind, but you're in valleys, you've got trees, you've got, you know, the 18th hole is down a hill, kind of tucked in underneath the high plateau, you know, and that gets wind. But that golf course, I wouldn't consider to be overly impacted by wind. The keep will be. And we have big greens, we have really big fairways. We have almost 100 acres of stadium zoysia fairway grass. And it's going to be very important on that golf course. It's a resort course. We want people to have a great time, but it has room. It has room to handle that wind. And so your big question, St. Andrews, Pebble Beach, even Augusta National, you know, there's all kinds of different looks of how you do things. And at St. Andrews, one of the key shots that I used during the 84 Open was chipping with a 6-iron. And I used it all week. Now, the third round, I never missed a green. So I didn't use it on the third round. But
sort of a humble brag. Yeah.
Hey, you know, those are big greens.
It was there for you. If brag. You needed it, it was there.
Not as big a brag as you would think, but I didn't miss a green. But I did bump a 6-iron because I don't know why at the time that seemed to be a club that, you know, it's hard to putt a 100-foot putt. And it's easier to sometimes chip those things. And so that was one shot I do remember that I used a lot over there. And you think about the short game requirements at Augusta National off mostly closely mown grass. And you think about the success of guys who played the European Tour and how well they've done at the Masters. I think that some of the, even though it looks 100% different, I think the shot values that you find at St. Andrews translate to Augusta National, hence your article about that will be coming up.
Perfect segue, Bill, because I was going to say you talked about, you know, looking at things from a different perspective in terms of St. Andrews. This article that Joe produced with your help will help a lot of people look at Augusta National in the same lens and a different perspective as it relates to the old course. Now, I'm just teeing it up, but Joe, tell the listeners what your article was about that's coming up in our spring issue and how Bill helped you with that.
Well, yeah, I think the purpose of the article really was the influences on Augusta on Bobby Jones and Alistair McKenzie. What were they thinking when they went to design Augusta National? And, you know, the premise was Augusta National owes 1/3 of its original design to the old course. So, meaning in the original literature that Alistair McKenzie and Bobby Jones produced, a brochure for the club, and in articles that they did at the time, 1931, 1932, they said, hey, this hole kind of, we borrowed the green complex from this one. And the shot value on this one is very similar to what you, and this one in St. Andrews. So being more specific, I looked into, you know, that concept. And you know, I thought, well, I mean, some of them, okay, I can see a resemblance, and some of them I can't. But part of the problem where I can't is that the Augusta holes have changed a lot over the years. And so what was it like at the beginning? Do they really match up? What's it like now? And I thought, you know, Bill might be somebody that could really offer some great insight as an architect, a very successful current modern architect, but someone who's walked Augusta National on multiple occasions and had a phenomenal 1984 British Open at St. Andrews. And that was the premise for this, and in Bill helping out. And so I basically threw it to Bill and said, what do you see when Alistair McKenzie and Bobby Jones compare, you know, as a, for instance, the fourth hole at Augusta National, the long par three, to the 11th, the famous par three, you know, at St. Andrews called the Eden. Are you seeing any resemblance or what? That was how we started this whole thing, and Bill did a beautiful job of explaining yay or nay.
Hey, that was a fun process. And, you know, it's anytime you we're all influenced. OK, I mean, you know, especially anybody in the creative world, I think in writing, I think in all kinds of things, you see something, it goes into your brain somewhere and it can come out at other times. And obviously, you know, I mean, how many architects have taken things from St. Andrews and said, hey, you know, this matters to me, and I'm going to put something like this on another golf course. And obviously McKenzie had done tremendous, you know, mapping and studying of St. Andrews. And probably nobody knew it better than he did at the time. And, you know, and I think Joe, you also mentioned there's a marketing aspect of it too. And I'm sure that was all part of it.
Bill, where do you think, you know, I'll let people who want to access the article and read it themselves, but where do you think is the best comparison where you can say, like, yes, you can definitely see the old course in Augusta at this specific hole? What
my
to you
favorite,
is the best?
Yeah, my favorite's the third hole. And I compare it to the 12th, although what happens on the 12th can also happen sort of on the 14th. But the 12th hole being a short par four, you have a lot of options off the tee. People weren't driving the green in 1984 that I remember. It was more a position hole. But the second shot, the distance control demanded on the second shot was it was demanded perfection. You could bounce it on though and run it up. You just needed to stop it on that in between area between the two lows where the flag seemed to be. And that was a really incredibly difficult shot. I love watching the third hole at the Masters. I think it's so exciting because there are so many birdies and there are train wrecks that happen right there on that hole. And so I think it's the best. And I think short par fours are great anyway, because it's not about distance. It's about strategy. It's about execution. And those two holes are, you know, very much that way.
I wanted to also ask you this. As you're talking about the third hole, I think that area behind, so you're kind of like to the side of three green behind 4T, and you can turn around and see the approach shot into two at Augusta at the Masters. I think that is my, like, that's my favorite place on the course to watch golf. What for you it would be like your spot where you know you want to watch, sit there and watch some golf for a while? Where's your favorite place to watch the Masters at Augusta?
Yeah, that's, you know, I love the approach into 10, because I think that's, I mean, it's, the 10 is one of my favorite holes out there. I think that every time you get to Sunday at Augusta, that 10th hole matters, because there's the occasional birdie, and then there's, you know, the occasional bogey. 14 green's a fun place to be. You're kind of right in the middle of a lot of things happening on the back nine. And so that's kind of an exciting spot. And then you've got elevation, you know, back behind 7, you get to see number 8 tee shot. You know, it's always you have to plan ahead out there. And when I go, I always want to see every hole. So I want to walk the entire golf course. I'm actually more interested in that than the players, honestly. No offense to the, but I'm going to get to watch plenty of the golf on TV and really enjoy that. And the Masters is can't miss at our house, has been forever. But when I get to the golf course, and especially depending on who I might be with, we want to walk every hole. I want to feel it in your feet. You want to see the contour of the greens because TV just can't show that. So I have probably every time I've been, I've walked all 18 holes. So I don't sit very long and watch one place.
Same for me in terms of wanting to walk the course. But Joe, same question for you. Where do you like to post up with a Georgia peach ice cream sandwich and watch?
If I have that ice cream sandwich, I don't care where I am on the course. I'm happy. I share Bill's affection for the approach shot into 10. Even from as you're standing on the side of the fairway and you get to look down at that green, but especially over that last huge sprawling remaining McKenzie bunker in the middle of the 10th fairway, which with particular pride, I say, I've been in it, and I'm only one of maybe three or four people in the last 80 years that actually found their golf ball there. Where I wish if the Masters poobahs were asking my opinion on how to change their golf course for players and spectators, my favorite place 30 years ago was at the elbow, the outside elbow of the par 5 13th, because that decision on a little bit of a downhill side hill lie to watch the players kind of, should I go for it? Should I not? Where should I lay up to? Where's the hole place today? That was my favorite shot in tournament golf. But when they planted more trees, extra trees, and it made it much more difficult for spectators to peer through those trees and actually see the shot come off. If I could recommend one change, yank out a few of those trees, think about doing something else, because that shot, even in, by today's standards, is still fun, you know, to see if the guys can pull it off.
Well, especially now that they back the tee up, that would allow the tree removal to be, I think, more viable for them.
And I think wave the flag, Bill. We got to wave the flag for that.
Just to make sure I'm clear, and you guys are talking about the 10th. Are you talking about the shot you're in the fairway kind of behind the player looking towards the green, or you're behind the green watching the shot come in?
Either, but more, I like being more where the player is. I do like watching the swings and seeing, you know, like Joe said on 13, they're on a little bit of an uncomfortable lie. And on 10, they used to be more on an uncomfortable lie. I think they drive it down into the flat more now than they used to. But that was always, I mean, just an incredibly difficult. And you remember the days, Joe, when they used to actually not all get down to the bottom. And you saw some guys going in with, you know, like a 4-wood or 4-irons or, you know, into the green. Now they're hitting certainly shorter shots.
So I want to talk a little bit about just your design business, you know, as we conclude this podcast. And one of the things I read from a good friend of mine from another golf publication, Golf Pass, Tim Gavrich, did a piece about you and your van. Albie. I want to know if you're still driving Albie around, and can you tell us a little bit about
it? We are. It's named Albatross, and we call it Albie because it's a rare bird and it's a good golf term. So and so we bought that almost 5 years ago. And so my son has worked for me for 8 years, and I have also two other guys who work for me. So there are four of us, but Matt and I primarily are the van guys, and we have, you know, worked extensively all over the South. And we literally were on a 2000 mile, 5 golf course trip. And I looked at him and I said, we got to do something different. This is such a waste of time in between, you know, going to projects. And so literally Matt and my wife, Mary, came up with the idea of the van. And, you know, we didn't know what that van was going to be at first. We looked at a bunch of different things, and then we settled on this Mercedes Sprinter. And it's been the best thing we could have possibly done. When we first got it, we'd spend the night in the parking lots of the clubhouses and Walmart parking lots as well, but a lot of clubhouse parking lots. You'd wake up, take a shower, off you go, start the day, and every minute that van is on the road, basically, or I'd say 90% of the time, I'm working. And so, you know, you drive to Memphis, and that's a 6-hour ride one way. And then we'd go to Nashville, because we always have projects in Nashville, and we do this triangular, and we might, you know, be in the, and spend 14 hours driving, and I get 12 hours worth of work during that time. And then Matt works in the van as well at times. And you have everything you need. It's like having a mini apartment. You've got, you know, clothing, grade rods, paint guns, paint and flags and everything that we need. So it's been awesome. And yeah, people do recognize it. We get honked at sometimes. And so people do know it, but it's got 190,000 miles on. It's actually getting two new front tires on it today. And it's been a lot of fun. And even on site, you know, guys, it's kind of a hangout place. So it's been a really nice thing. I saw Tad Layton bought a similar type setup, but he's on his own, so that you don't get the work time. And see, the work time's been incredibly valuable. I'm in my office today. I think last year we had 12 jobs under construction last year, and I don't think I was in my office a weekday for the whole year until Christmas. I traveled every day last year. It was brutal, but good. And that van, I get more done in the van than anywhere else, because I don't have anything else to do. And it just is sort of my happy spot. I sit sideways. I don't sit in the back seat. I sit in the side seat. It's smoother that way. And I know when we're in Macon, Georgia, because the road's horrible. And I know we're in various places because you're drawing on AutoCAD or working on the computer the whole time driving. And it's been fantastic.
You know, Al, I've been writing about architecture for about 35 years, and this is actually the first time I've heard design credit placed on new tires and maybe a new quart of oil as a key to design success. So we're breaking news right here.
And you're doing it with your son. I mean, how great is that to have
him? It's so great. So he's been working for me 8 years this spring. And it started out part-time because I needed a little bit of help. And, you know, I had one assistant pretty regularly from 2000 until about 2009. And then the recession came, and I never, you know, everybody, you just couldn't have anybody. And then I didn't gear back up with anybody. And at one point I said, hey, I just asked him, you want to make some money? I'll teach you how to do certain things on AutoCAD, and you can actually really help me. And so he did. And he's a theater major, so he's got really good vision and spatial awareness and things like that. And he's a good presenter. He's really good with people, but he learned AutoCAD instantly, and that really made me mad, honestly, because I know the guys who taught me AutoCAD, they're like, oh my gosh, are you ever going to remember a command? You were talking about my memory for golf is a lot better than my memory for keyboard strokes and what you need to do for AutoCAD. But we're quite good at it now, and Matt learned it instantly, and he does a tremendous amount of drone work. We do drone topos and aerials, and very valuable. We do try to embrace modern technology, even though we like to design golf courses with a classic style.
All right. So, Bill, we know you have the Keep going on right now as one of your current projects. What else do you have in the works? Where can people expect to see your next projects?
Yeah, I think one of the most exciting things we've had in the last couple of years, I've predominantly worked on private clubs. And, you know, people see your work and they go, well, we can't go play there. And that's a little frustrating. And so the exciting thing is, yes, people can go play the Keep. That is really cool. And that's at a level of golf that we're all going to see in August. Okay. And it's a really neat place. But we also reimagined and built two brand new public golf courses last year on top of old golf courses. So the city of Memphis hired us to redo Audubon. They gave me extra land. We added a 6-hole short course. We added a driving range. We got a 7,000-yard golf course that the, you know, Memphis University golf team would be proud to play. and it's in a beautiful part of Memphis. That opens this summer. Really excited. Everybody's going to get to play that. It's going to be a really nice old school golf course for the you know, city of Memphis. And then we did the same thing at Auburn, Alabama. They had a golf course that an airport expansion condemned 10 acres and ruined four holes. And so I master planned it several years ago, and then we just opened it this fall, but it's a brand new 18-hole golf course. There's not a single hole in the same place, not one. And so everybody can play those. And so, you know, that's pretty exciting because, again, our market's been really nice, you know, private clubs that people can't play. And so to have three golf courses, you know, that just either just opened or opening this summer that people can go play is pretty exciting.
Very good. Well, Bill, we appreciate your time and your expertise. Look forward to seeing everything you've got in the works and watching the Masters this year through a different lens and going to those places that you talked about. I'm excited to step foot where you said that you like to view the action again and, you know, reinvigorate my perspective on that place.
Well, thank you, Al and Joe. And I hope to see you guys in person up on the mountain, as I think you guys will find it quite fascinating. And it's a one of a kind. It's really a one of a kind golf course up there.
Looking forward to it.
I'll race you to the top, Joe.
My money's on you.
All right. Thanks again, Bill.
All right, guys. Have a great day.